There is a story about two rabbis, Hillel and Shammai. The story dates back to the first century BCE. A Gentile comes to Rabbi Shammai asking, "Teach me the law while standing on one foot." Which means something to the matter of, "Teach me the law, but keep it quick, I have other stuff to do." Rabbi Shammai ran the man off, chased him out, because he said there was no way to teach the whole law while standing on one foot. The law is too complicated. The same man goes to Rabbi Hillel, asking the same thing. "Teach me the law while standing on one foot." Hillel takes a different approach, saying, "What is hateful to you, to your neighbor, don't do. That's the entirety of the law. Everything else is commentary. So go study." Similarly, in the Gospel of Luke, a teacher of the law who might have known this story of Hillel and Shammai came to Jesus and said, "What must we do to inherit eternal life?" Jesus responds shortly, "What's written in the law?" And having been trained in the commentary around Hillel and Shammai, and having been trained in the law, the teacher of the law says, "You shall love the Lord your God with your heart and with your soul and with all your strength," the Shema, which is in Exodus. And then he says, "and with all your mind, and your neighbor as yourself." Jesus said, "Good answer. Go do that." But then the teacher of the law takes the question a step further and says, "But who is my neighbor?" Jesus goes on to tell a story. There's a guy traveling from one place to another. He's robbed, left for dead. Begging for help, this man reaches out first to a priest who is just walking by. The priest chooses to pass on the other side without looking at the man. A little while later, a Levite, who is another kind of priest, walks by. And the man begs, and the Levite passes on the other side so that he doesn't have to look at the man. And it's significant that these two pass on the other side, especially in a culture that their faith utilizes a ritual cleanness and profaneness. One could argue that they might have in some sense done the right thing, because to be made ritually clean again would take more time than the business they might have needed to practice should this man die or should they be covered in this blood. But then comes the third man, a Samaritan. And understand, for reasons I don't want to get into now, Samaritans were treated like a lower class person. Their blood wasn't pure. In fact, the two groups didn't like each other very much, and the Samaritans were often oppressed by the higher class. The Samaritan decides he's going to help the man. He helps him to his feet. He takes him to get help for his wounds. He pays for a hotel room. He pays more. He tells the guy that he'll be back in a couple weeks. If it's not enough money, he'll give more money. The Samaritan goes above and beyond to help this gentleman. And Jesus asks, who was his neighbor? The answer is fairly straightforward, and we know this. The Samaritan was the man's neighbor in the story. And because neighboring goes both ways, because I just can't be your neighbor, you would end up being my neighbor too. One of the earliest practitioners of and theologians behind liberation theology, Gustavo Gutierrez, says this: if I define my neighbor as the one I must go out to look for on the highways, in the byways, in the factories, in the slums, on the farms, and in the mines, then my world changes. Gustavo Gutierrez, a Catholic priest from Lima, Peru, like many Catholic leaders of the time, articulated liberation theology's preferential option for the poor, God's preferential option for the poor, which became central to classic liberation theology and in some levels considerable Catholic doctrine. Liberation theology, like liberal theology, which is our tradition, looks at the world and sees inequality and realizes that we are responsible for making changes to destroying inequality. Both traditions look at the social sciences to understanding the world. Both realize that understanding God begins with understanding our experience in the world. Understanding that there is no way to remove bias from the equation. We understand that people all over the world and often right around us live without freedom, and we are responsible for helping them find their freedom and bringing that freedom back. The theological ideals are rooted both in social practices between liberal and liberation theology. However, Marjorie Bowen's Wheatley reminds us and describes the difference in, let's say, the incompatibility between liberal and liberation theologies. She says liberalism's approach is inadequate, in part because its tendency to view freedom in the abstract without exploring a critical question. Freedom for whom? To do what? Gutierrez and other liberation theologians, in articulating God's preferential option for the poor, make clear the priorities of their faith. Faith is more than a thought experience or experiment. It's more than a debate, more than a social club. It serves that it doesn't just serve self. In liberation theology, faith is praxis. It is something we do. By articulating God's preferential option for the poor, these faith leaders identify the central active purpose of the church, the eradication of poverty and oppression. But the preferential option, even to the poor, tends to make liberal theologians uncomfortable. The idea that of a God that, as Wheatley says, takes sides, can be difficult for liberal. If we articulate a deity in liberal faith, which, by the way, isn't necessary, we tend to prefer that that deity be neutral, treating everyone the same. Leading Unitarian Universalist Jack Mendelsohn to ask the question, where is the scene of our oppression? Buried in middle-class standards, that's where it is, tucked into benefits that infuriatingly unjust social structures have bestowed upon them. Yes, they would like to share these benefits with the less fortunate, those who have been locked out and denied access, but at little or no cost to themselves or their children. But the most common thing that makes us uncomfortable is our misunderstanding of God's preferential treatment to the poor that Gutierrez champions. Patricia Jimenez explains this very well, saying, a theology of liberation requires that we all, oppressors and oppressed alike, learn and understand what is oppressive. In African American liberation theology, theologians like James Cone seek to make suffering redemptive. Redemptive suffering takes an important role with this preferential option. See, with Cone, the willingness to put life on the line for what is right is central in practice and faith. He does this holistically in his theological book, The Cross and the Lynching Tree, where he articulates the redemptive nature of the suffering of African Americans during the Jim Crow era. In doing so, Cone seeks to bring meaning to the meaninglessness of suffering. Mammy Till, Brady, the mother of Emmett Till, who was killed in Mississippi and lynched in Mississippi for whistling at a white woman, insisted on an open casket showing Emmett's body open for all to see. In doing so, she chose not to hide the violence that had been committed to her son. She would give meaning to his death. And in doing so, Emmett's death turned into a national outcry. 600,000 people viewed the bloated and disfigured corpse of Emmett Till, and millions more across the globe when images were published in Jet magazine, leaving Mammy Till Bradley to say that her boy didn't die in vain. Upon opening the casket, she said, "This is not for Emmett, but to make it safe for other boys." However, there's a danger in focusing too strongly on the role of suffering as a central aspect in salvation. This is another thing that makes us uncomfortable as liberals with liberation theology, is understanding appropriately the role of suffering. Rebecca Parker articulates this along with Rita Nakashima Brock in their book Saving Paradise, and William Jones articulates it in his book Is God a White Racist? A Preamble to Black Theology. Though it might be reasonable to give meaning to suffer as a liberal, I am careful not to justify suffering. Whether it be the battery of a body or the violence that is poverty itself. The suffering Savior then reminds us that suffering is part of the human condition, but we must always draw that line to realize that suffering is not the point of the human condition. We work to build a world where suffering be not necessary for others. Because we've already built too much on suffering in this culture. It was the suffering of slaves that fortified the stabilization of the American system at the birth in the nation. It was the suffering of the native people that gave way to so-called manifest destiny that gave us a much larger nation with many more resources to pull from. It was the suffering of Chinese immigrants that built our railroads that allowed us to transverse this large tract of land in just a few days. It was the suffering of Japanese Americans in internment camps during World War II that brought us comfort. And it was the suffering of African Americans during Jim Crow that provided the background for a legalized servant class, kicking off a period of capitalist expansion in a post-World War II bloom. We can say that suffering is redemptive if we truly understand what Cohn and Martin Luther King did about suffering. But we can't say this in the traditional, what I would call, evangelical methodology that says Jesus and his suffering paid a price for all our sins. No man need pay price for any of my sins. My sins are my responsibility. When does redemptive suffering turn into just exploitation? Who is being redeemed? Which is why suffering is such a confounding topic. James Cone says this in The Cross and the Lynching Tree. What is redemptive? Oh no, he says this in Social Witness. It's a Unitarian Universalist book. What is redemptive is when people are inspired to say, "What you do to my body cannot destroy who I am." There is an inner spirit of freedom and identity that is powerful, that what you do to the physical body cannot destroy who I am. And if we understand that is the meaning of redemptive suffering, we are much further down our path of understanding truth in liberation theologies. Emmett Till's suffering was given meaning, not because meaning was inherent but because his suffering led to something unexpected. But the problems of theodicy, the problems of suffering, they're way too large for this sermon that started by asking the question, who is my neighbor? The fact is, it's not below the white man's pride to trade black lives for security, brown lives for labor, women's lives for progeny. In fact, it's central to the American exceptionalism. The problem is not that we don't know that this exploitation exists. The problem is the cost of ending it is too expensive. We can look at a person sleeping under an overpass and feel some deep sympathy and argue it away by cuddling with meritocracy, not overtly, just a little bit, in the back room, when we remind ourselves that the problem is too big while our social justice warrior self is doing other things. But then we remember the question, who is my neighbor? Especially if Gutierrez says the neighbor is the person who is sought. So just once, when you're walking through North Tulsa or Midtown and you pass someone asleep on the sidewalk, which is a common thing, reflect on the agenda of the homeless. Imagine what their day looks like. Imagine a full 24 hours that involves business owners and police moving them along, knowing that the shelters are generally in places where they have to get out at 6 o'clock in the morning and get away from that space because the business owners immediately want to clear it out. Freezing temperatures, blistering heat, hunger, the line at the soup kitchen where the oppressed oppress also each other, where there is violence. Trying to get to the shelter before dark to get a bed, trying to find the $5 it takes sometimes to rent that bed, the sweet bliss of forgetfulness that alcohol and drugs might bring when one looks back at their broken and resented life. Remember that, or imagine this reminder that they lay exposed on a sidewalk having forgiven or having given away or being open to the violence that could take place to them by people of ill repute. And remember that when this person that you are walking by dies, no one will care. And put yourself there just for a moment. Put yourself in that place of suffering. Imagine the cold ground beneath your hip. Imagine the crumpled belongings you keep under your head so no one can steal them. Imagine the people that walk by and kick. Imagine the store owners that drive you off. Just imagine the concrete below your hip. And ask if Americans are so exceptional, what's all this about? Then there is this tradition in many black families called the talk. The talk outlines how they're to act when they get pulled over by the police. The talk is not something they like having to do, but it's been something that's been done traditionally for a long time in African American families when they're young boys get old enough to start looking and be mistaken for men. If they're getting pulled over, they say, pull over right away. Keep your hands visible at all times. Don't reach for anything until you inform the officer first. Be polite. Say, yes, sir, no, sir. Don't argue, even if you're right. Because even a routine check can turn into the loss of life for black boys. And I'll be honest, when I get pulled over, my biggest concern is that I don't have my current insurance card or that I forgot to get my new car tag. I'm not worried about what the police officer is going to say to me, and I'm not worried about whether or not I'm going to drive away. When I get pulled over, I'm just frustrated that I'm being inconvenienced. If you've never had to have the talk with your child, think about it next time a police car gets behind you or is sitting on the side of the road, or the next time you see the blue lights going in your rear view. Can we empathize with them radically? We may never realize or really understand liberation theology, but what we can do is empathize with people that are not us, people that are radically not us. We can believe them. We can affirm what they say. And this is not about feeling guilt. That's a mistake we often make in liberal settings. This is not about guilt. It's not about white guilt. It's not about middle class guilt. It's not about upper class guilt. This is not about guilt. It isn't about negating our own suffering or work. It doesn't mean that we haven't worked hard. It's just about empathy. I think back to the times I was bullied as a child. I think about high school when I just couldn't make sense of algebra and had to accept my D. I think back to the time I was weeping with my Greek teacher because I just couldn't get it. After hours and hours and years of study, I think about my bout with homelessness, my struggles with depression and anxiety. And I think about all the resources I had access to that made it possible to survive those things. A loving family, a middle-class upbringing, a good church home, people that believed in me, unemployment insurance, health insurance, car insurance. I was never molested or physically abused. I was raised to believe that if I had just stuck to my guns, no matter how bad it could be, I could be Luke Skywalker or Jean-Luc Picard, regardless as to what was thrown at me. But see, that's what it took for me to survive just to get here. When I think about what I received just by having a family that chose to love me imperfectly, the difference between my upbringing and that of others is drastic. And there's a word for all those things I just said that gave me the opportunity to be this quirky, neurodivergent, sometimes depressed, music-loving, video game-playing, music-watching preacher that utilizes references half of you may not get for his own personal joy. When I think about this person that I've become and I think about what helped me along that way, the things that gave me this opportunity above others, well, the word is called privilege. Culturally, we can look at that as a bad word. But see, some of my privilege is white. Some of my privilege is male. Some of it's class. But it's there. And I have to know it's there. I have it, and other people don't. And if I don't know my privilege is there, how can I truly ask the question, who is my neighbor? Because in the Bible story, the neighbor was the guy who went out of his way to help the man who was left for dead. Gutierrez said, if I define my neighbor as the one I must go out to look for on the highways, in the byways, in the factories, in the slums, on the farms, and in the mines, then my world changes. But the poor person does not, he goes on to say, the poor person does not exist as an inescapable fact of destiny. His or her existence is not politically neutral, and it's not ethically innocent. The poor are a byproduct of the system in which we live and for which we are responsible. They are marginalized by our social and cultural world. They are oppressed, exploited, an exploited proletariat, robbed of the fruit of their labor and despoiled of their humanity. And finally, he says, hence the poverty of the poor is not a call to generous relief action, but a demand that we go on and build a different social order. It's important as we go forward as a people of a liberal faith, that even if we can't fully understand something, we can seek to find empathy. It's important to understand that, yes, it was hard to get to this point for many of us. We worked, we sweat, we cried, and we bled. It doesn't mean we didn't have privilege. And that's not a bad thing. What if everything wasn't so blasted competitive? What if that privilege was just natural to the human condition? It's not about guilt. It's not about looking at what we have and feeling guilty because we have it and we don't. No one wants anyone to feel guilty. That is not what liberation means. But liberation has to be rooted in empathy. It has to be rooted in an ability to see people for who they are and who they can be, and also to see ourselves so that we can reflect more openly when we ask the question, who is my neighbor? Thank you. Every month, we choose a generosity recipient, and we donate directly to that generosity recipient. And if you'd like to do that, to donate to the Alzheimer's Association, I would ask that you make your checks out to Hope Unitarian Church and write generosity in the recipient line. All cash donations do go to the generosity recipient. But I also want to remind you that this is also the time we make our pledge. Though I don't say it on a weekly level, your pledge goes towards the continuation of having a staff, of having me. Your pledge goes to the continuation of turning on the lights. Your pledge goes to the continuation of having it warm in the winter, even in my office, though I never turn the heat on, and cool in the summer. Your pledge helps us to help others. It helps us to help work within structures. It helps us when action needs members. It helps us when Tulsa Metropolitan Ministries wants to do something. It helps us to change the world. Your pledge is important. And please never overlook the necessity of that financial pledge that you give to this congregation. Hey, Arlo. So please give with love and hope for the future that we'll build together. Thank you. And we are reminded that we do not do this alone, and we give thanks. We build on foundations we did not lay. We warm ourselves at fires we did not light. We sit in the shade of trees we did not plant. We drink from wells we did not dig. We profit from persons we did not know. We are ever bound in community. Our final hymn will be We'll Build a Land, and I'll offer you the opportunity to rise in body or spirit as you feel so called. And let's sing 121 together. And we extinguish your chalice by saying, we extinguish this flame, but not the light of truth, the warmth of community, or the fires of commitment.
These we carry in our hearts until we are together again.
Oh, I have the perfect benediction. Hold on. I found it. Hold on. What is hateful to you, to your neighbor, don't do. That's the entirety of the law. Everything else is commentary. So go study. In peace.
Thank you.